Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 80 countries around the world over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the fluoride deception right after this. You know, we Americans are the most litigious people in the world. We believe in our lawyers with a kind of religious fervor, and we're taught from early childhood that he who represents himself in court as a fool for a client. But what would you say if your plumber said that? What if your plumber said, he who fixes his own pipes as a fool for a client? What if your carpenter said that? He who fixes his own steps as a fool for a client. Now, doesn't our common sense tell us that a plumber or a carpenter who can't fix his own pipes or fix his own steps is incompetent? You know, my common sense tells me that a lawyer who can't represent himself has to be just as incompetent as that plumber or that carpenter. Listen to James Nielsen. Now, he's a professor, a law school professor at Hastings Law School. Here's what he said. He said it's a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having written a pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed. And he said it's worse than that. He said most of the students graduate from this law school without ever having seen a real honest-to-God pleading, contract, will, promissory note, or a deed. And a student can graduate without having set foot in a courtroom, without ever having spoken to or on behalf of a person in need of advice or counsel. And a student can graduate without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court. Now, whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, let it be said that for these students and for their clients, that it is a cruel hoax. That's Professor James Nielsen from the Hastings Law School. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. While you're at it, be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and it's free. Courtroom Strategy and Procedure is our school, available on compact disc for adult home education. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click on the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. Hey, we're talking about fluoride. This is the book. It's called The Fluoride Deception. Reads like a novel, and it's the history of fluoride. It's not here to tell you that, you know, fluoride's bad for you and blah, blah, blah. Although the book does leave you with that impression. You know, when you get through, if you think fluoride's still good for you, then obviously you've been on fluoride too long. But aside from that, where the bodies are buried, the historicity of it was, I thought, compelling. I never knew where the fluoride thing got started. Who sold us this fluoride to start with? Who sold us this Corvair car that's unsafe at any speed? You know, we listen to what we see in our newspapers and hear on the radio, or we see on television. We see advertisements that tell us that Kix is good for kids, you know, or Kellogg's Corn Flakes, you know, or this or that or something else, you know. Or we have an association, you know, like Tom Mix, you know, he eats Quaker Oats or whatever it is that they're advertising or selling. So pretty soon, you know, if Batman eats it, it's got to be good. If Superman eats it, you know, I want to be like Superman. And, you know, we go to school, and our teachers, you know, they tell us about fluoride and how good it is, and they give us some history, you know. And they tell us the good side, they don't tell us the bad side. And they tell us part of the story, but they don't tell us all of the story. And so here on the Law Hour, an editorial review, what we like to do is tell you the other side of the story and then let you make up your own mind. You know, I'm not here to tell you not to, you know, not to brush your teeth with fluoride toothpaste. I don't care whether you do or not. I don't. My cows don't. My cows never brush their teeth, period. Let alone with fluoride toothpaste. And I'm very satisfied with the dental hygiene of my cattle. And they're doing quite nicely, thank you. There's not a single cavity. I've been here 25 years on this farm. 25 years on this farm. Not a single cavity in any cow in 25 years. And I have about an average of 30 here, you know, year round. So, you take that record over there. Boy, I'll take that record to the bank any day of the week. Now, I've had a personal record, you know, dates back to about 1950. I had my first cavity about 1950. And I've had one cavity after another from then on. I think I've had a cavity in just about every tooth in my head. Not quite, but almost. And, you know, over a long period of time, you know, I've eaten a lot of Krispy Kremes and Winchell's Donuts and Dunkin' Donuts and drank a lot of Coca-Cola and ate a lot of white bread. And my cows never did any of the above. And so I took a look at that and I experimented, you know, with my own children. I'm quite a scientist, you know. And I experimented with my children. After having rotted all my teeth out of my head, I changed their diet a little bit and found out that when I didn't give them Coca-Cola, Krispy Kremes, and white bread, their teeth didn't rot out of their heads just like my cows. And so I came to a conclusion. Now, my kids never had fluoride in their water. I avoided fluoride like AIDS, herpes, and VD. And I just told you about one of the girls that just left home the other day, and she ran off and got married, and she ain't got a cavity in her head. The young fellow that married her married well. And he starts off, you know, with a wife with no cavities. Isn't that amazing? No fluoride, no Coca-Cola. I mean, that girl avoids Coke like she avoids, you know, AIDS. And so my conclusion is that fluoride is not a necessary ingredient in your health. Well, that was my conclusion. I wouldn't say that fluoride is going to cause tooth decay, but I can tell you pretty plainly that fluoride is not a nutritional deficiency if you don't have it. Now, this lady that's doing this work, her name is Dr. Phyllis Mullinex, and she got a spooky feeling one hot July evening in 1995 when the phone rang. Dr. Phyllis Mullinex was in her office upstairs in her Andover, Massachusetts home. Scientific papers were strewn all over the floor. Tells you that she's a messy, messy girl. And she had been depressed. Her firing from Forsyth the previous summer had hit the family hard. Her daughters were applying to college, and she and her husband, Rick, were quarreling about money. Oh, my God. You know, if you're a scientist and you get crosswise with the establishment, it could lead to divorce and quarreling with your husband. She lifted the receiver. A big bass voice boomed an apology from New York City for calling so late. Mullinex did not recognize the speaker. She settled back into her favorite white leather armchair. Joel Griffiths explained that he was a medical writer in Manhattan. He had a request. Would Mullinex look at some odd documents from the files of the medical section of the Manhattan Project, the once super-secret scientific organization that had built the world's first atomic bomb? Mullinex rolled her eyes. It was late. Rick, now an air traffic controller, was trying to sleep in the next room. The atom bomb, Mullinex thought. What on earth did that have to do with fluoride? Mullinex's own patience was growing thin. Since her research had become public, she had been bombarded with phone calls and letters from anti-fluoride activists. Some of the callers had been battling the water fluoridation issue since the 1950s. Late-night radio talk shows were especially hungry to speak with the Harvard scientist who thought the fluoride was dangerous. They called her at 3 or 4 in the morning from across the country and overseas. Usually, there was no thank you note, and you never heard from them again, Mullenix said. I told you this thing reads like a novel, didn't I? Talk about excitement. Talk about sitting on the edge of your seat. Yes, yes, children, what does fluoride have to do with the Manhattan Project, or what does the atomic bomb have to do with fluoride in your children's toothpaste? Well, stick around. There's more to come. So this New York reporter dropped a bombshell. Dr. Harold Hodge. Remember this guy Hodge from yesterday's program? The old man who worked at Forsyth? The old guy that just died? Okay, that's the guy. This guy, Harold Hodge, Mullenix's old laboratory colleague, was described in the documents as the Manhattan Project's chief medical expert on fluoride, Griffiths told her. Workers and families living near atomic bomb factories during the war had been poisoned by fluoride, according to the documents, and Harold Hodge had investigated. Mullenix felt a sudden spooky feeling. She shifted in her chair. Harold Hodge was now dead, but as the journalist continued, Mullenix cast her mind back to the days in her Forsyth laboratory with the kindly old gentleman, the grandfatherly figure who had sometimes played with her children. And all he ever did was ask questions. She told Griffiths all he ever did was ask questions. He would sit there and he would nod his head and he would say, "You don't say, you don't say." And once, Mullenix recalled, as Harold Hodge watched her experiments, that he had briefly mentioned working for the Manhattan Project, but he had never said that fluoride had anything to do with nuclear weapons, or that he had once measured the toxic effects of fluoride on atomic bomb workers. Yes, Mullenix told the journalist, she did want to see the documents. Some days later, a colleague of Griffiths arrived at the Mullenix home. Clifford Honecker was his name, and he handed her a thick folder of documents. Honecker was part of a small group of researchers and reporters who had unearthed many of the ghoulish medical secrets of the Manhattan Project and the Atomic Energy Commission. Those secrets had included details about the scores of shocking Cold War human radiation experiments on hospital patients, on prisoners, on pregnant women, and retarded children, just like the Germans did. For years, the media had ignored the information about human experimentation that Honecker and others were discovering. Finally, in 1995, an investigative journalist named Eileen Welsom had won a Pulitzer Prize for revealing how atomic bomb program doctors had injected plutonium into hospital patients in Tennessee and New York. She uncovered names of the long-ago victims. Harold Hodge had planned and supervised many of those experiments, the documents showed. President Bill Clinton ordered an investigation. His energy secretary, Hazel O'Leary, began a new policy of openness. And Honecker and others had gained access to newly declassified Cold War documents, including much of the new information on fluoride. That night, after Honecker left, Mullenix settled into her chair and began to read. Her face drained as she read one memo in particular. The 50-year-old document mentioned Harold Hodge and discussed fluoride's effect on the brain and central nervous system. It was the same work that she had just completed at the Forsyth Dental Center. I went white. I was outraged, Mullenix said. I was hollering. I was pacing the floor. He wrote this memo saying that he knew fluoride would affect the central nervous system. The central nervous system memo, stamped secret, is addressed to the head of the Manhattan Project's medical section, Colonel Stafford Warren, and it was dated April 29, 1944. It is a request to conduct animal experiments to measure the central nervous system effects of fluoride. Dr. Harold Hodge wrote the research proposal. Clinical evidence suggests that uranium hexafluoride may have a rather marked central nervous system effect. It seems most likely that the code F, that's not the F word, kids, the code F, code for fluoride component, rather than the T code for uranium, is the causative factor, states the memo. A light flashed on for Mullinex. At the time, in 1996, she was still sending grant requests to the National Institutes of Health in Washington, D.C., asking to continue her studies on fluoride's central nervous system effects. A panel of National Institute of Health scientists had turned down her application, flatly telling her fluoride does not have central nervous system effects. Mullinex realized the absurdity of what she had been doing. Harold Hodge and the government had suspected fluoride's toxic effects on the human nervous system for more than half a century. And Hodge had designed the experiments during World War II and conducted the experiments on human guinea pigs. But it was all classified, top secret. She read on. The 1944 memo explained why research on fluoride's central nervous system effects was vital to the United States war effort. Since work with these compounds is essential, it will be necessary to know in advance what mental effects may occur after exposure in humans. This is important not only to protect a given individual, but also to prevent a confused workman from injuring others by improperly performing his duties. Unquote. All of a sudden it dawned on me, said Mullinex. Harold Hodge, back in the 1940s, had asked the military to do a study that I had done at Forsyth. Hodge knew all of this 50 years ago from working on human guinea pigs. He wasn't working on rats. Why didn't he tell me this? Why didn't he tell me that he was interested in central nervous system experimentation? Why didn't he say to me, this stuff I know is a neurotoxin? But all he did was ask questions. And he would sit there, and he would nod his head, and he would say, you don't say, you don't say. He never once said, I know it's a neurotoxin. I know it causes confusion. I know it causes lassitude. I know it causes drowsiness. Today, Mullinex calls Harold Hodge a monster for his human radiation experiments. In retrospect, she compares sharing a laboratory with Harold Hodge with being in a movie theater eating popcorn with the Boston Strangler. Had the two Rochester alumni, Jack Hine and Harold Hodge, manipulated the toxicologist to perform the fluoride studies that Hodge had proposed 50 years earlier, she wondered? Did they let Mullinex take the fall when her experiments proved what Hodge had already known? At first, Mullinex had shown no interest in studying fluoride, she remembered, and it seems strange that a neurotoxicology person was brought into a dental institution to look at fluoride, Mullinex said. I felt that I had really been lied to, or led along, led down the primrose path, she added. I was used like a puppet. Mullinex called up Jack Hine. Hine denied knowing anything about Harold Hodge's long-ago Manhattan Project fears that fluoride was a neurotoxin, she said, and instead he offered to pass the explosive information on to the government, telling Mullinex, shouldn't you tell the NIDR? Do you want me to help you take it to the NIDR? Hine asked. Now, Hine may have known far more than he told Mullinex. In a 1997 interview with the United Kingdom's Channel 4 television, he disclosed that one of the primary concerns of the Manhattan Project toxicologists had seen fluoride's effects on the central nervous system. The next day, Dr. Mullinex called the head of the National Institute of Dental Research, Dr. Harold Slavkin. She hoped that the nation's top dental officer would be concerned about the wartime memo. But instead, she remembers, he got very upset. In fact, he was nasty. And he basically pushed me off like I was some kind of crackpot. She thought that NIDR, that's the National Institute for Dental Research, would be interested in the memos that dated back to experiments done during World War II, that the Institute would want to read them. But he treated her as if she were some kind of a wacko. So she put the telephone down, then a terrible truth dawned. The public guardians at the National Institutes of Health, the national guardians like Harold Hodge, also had a double identity. It seemed that they, too, were keepers of Cold War national security secrets, bureaucratic sentries at the portcullis of the nuclear industrial state. Hey, what a twist, huh? God, that ought to frost you. Now listen, that's the beginning of the book. That tells you where the bodies are buried. And it tells you a little something about who these bodies are. Harold Hodge was a very serious player in the game. And at the very beginning of the book, he identifies these big players. You know, like Dr. Albert W. Burgstaller. Dr. Samuel S. Epstein. He was the chairman of the Cancer Prevention Coalition and professor emeritus of environmental and occupational medicine. This Dr. Burgstaller over here, he was with the International Society for Fluoride Research and emeritus professor of organic chemistry at the University of Kansas. Now listen, boys and girls, many of these men, eminent professors in their colleges, in earlier times during the war had worked on the Manhattan Project. They knew what this fluoride was. They knew how toxic it was. They knew what a killer it was. They knew how dangerous it was. And they had to change its perception. Now listen, listen to this word right here. Arsenic. Now ask yourself, when I said the word arsenic, what came into your mind? Oh my God, arsenic, deadly poison, skull and crossbones, just something, a terrible negative feeling comes over you. Strychnine! All right, now, what kind of a feeling came over you when I said the word strychnine? Here comes that skull and crossbones. Here comes that deadly feeling like, oh my God, toxic poison. You ready for this one? Fluoride! Jesus. You know, the first thing comes into my mind when I say fluoride is Crest toothpaste. I can't associate fluoride with a deadly toxin, poison, skull and crossbones. You know, I've been propagandized all my life. Fluoride to me is like baking soda. Is something you use in your cooking. It's something you put in your mouth. It's something you drink in your water. Fluoride? Why, what's wrong with fluoride? All right, now here's the problem. See, during the 20s and 30s, the word fluoride had the same connotation as arsenic and strychnine. In fact, there's a toxicology chart that they reveal here in the book. Fluoride is more toxic than arsenic or strychnine. You know, if you said, what do you want to use to kill yourself, what you do is take a dose of fluoride. Now, fluoride is given to you in very minute quantities. I think it's one part per million. So you drink a million parts of water and there's one part of fluoride in there. It's not very much. But if I said, let's put one part per million of arsenic in the water, let's put one part per million of strychnine in the water, see, your attitude would change. You'd say, no, I don't want to do that. And that's because, you see, you have a negative reaction to arsenic and strychnine, but fluoride is more toxic than arsenic and strychnine combined. I mean, you could take the arsenic and strychnine and mix them together. They wouldn't be as toxic as the fluoride. Now, we needed to change your mental outlook concerning fluoride in order to get you to eat it. In order to get you to drink Coca-Cola, you know, we've got to put a positive twist to this. And this is what spin is all about. Let me give you an illustration of spin. Here's an article from the Wall Street Journal. And it's entitled, just took this off the web last night. I said, hey, Dirk, go get me something on fluoride. He comes back and he says, government panel raises concern about fluoride. National Academy of Sciences calls current ceiling unsafe. Monitoring your local supply. And then here's some more sub-headlines. Fluoride fears. About 200,000 people live where water has fluoride levels of at least 4 milligrams per liter, a level thought to carry risks. An additional 1.4 million people live where natural concentrations are between 2 and 3.9 micrograms per liter. Children exposed to the highest allowed levels risk developing fluorosis, in which teeth are discolored and scarred. People who consume water with elevated fluoride over a lifetime are likely to increased risk for bone fractures. Hey, that's propaganda. It's propaganda. This is psychological warfare at its best, at its finest, at its apex. I mean, this is genius. Absolute genius. Sure, look at this. Government panel raises concern about fluoride. You read the article. I read you some of the subtext headlines. There isn't anything in here that would make you feel that fluoride is a danger to you. In fact, when you get through with this, this is a negative article about fluoride. And when you get through, you will have a positive response to fluoride. That is, sure, people who consume water with elevated fluoride over a lifetime are likely to have increased risk for bone fractures. I mean, the worst thing that can happen to you is that you're going to have a broken bone, maybe, or that maybe it'll discolor your teeth, maybe. But it certainly won't kill you. It's not a poison. It's not life-threatening. Broken bones don't threaten your life. Discolored teeth don't threaten your life. So when you get through reading the article, there isn't anything in here about fluoride that's life-threatening. There's nothing in the article that tells you that fluoride is more toxic than arsenic or strychnine either. Now, what we need to do is we will write positive articles about fluoride and tell you how it's going to prevent tooth decay. Then we will write negative articles about fluoride and tell you the worst thing that can happen to you. You could break your bones, you know. You know, if you take that fluoride, you could have discolored teeth, you know. And you're sitting there saying, big deal. It's like somebody saying, you know, you could smoke that cigarette and get lung cancer, you know. When was the last time you smoked a cigarette and got lung cancer? Huh? Can you tell me the day you got lung cancer from smoking a cigarette? All right. Now, this is what psychological warfare is all about. And we've all been indoctrinated into fluoride through psycho warfare. All right, hang on. I got to give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. Now, if you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective, 8 schools and all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives that can be accessed through the website as well. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. That's for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Remember, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do that 7 days a week. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. We often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. But these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we endorse and recommend are going to reciprocate. And that's because most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour, they may be, not necessarily, but they may be hostile. They can be political. They may be religious or economic. They could be sectarian. They can be racial or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or of this local radio station. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, remember our website is georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the fluoride deception. Reads like a novel. Tells you where the bodies are buried, identifies the names, dates, times, places, facts, witnesses, and evidence. It's a historical chronology of the fluoride deception, where they started and how they carried on this psychological war to make you believe that fluoride is good for you. It would be the equivalent of taking arsenic and making you believe that it's good for you. And believe me, they can do that. If the government set about today, I mean, you know, they probably couldn't change your views or your opinion, and you'd probably go into your grave believing that arsenic is bad for you and that it's a deadly toxic poison. However, if you start off over a long period of time, and you introduce arsenic and say, gee, new scientific discovery. We just found out that arsenic cures balding. You know, I don't know, maybe arsenic might make your hair grow back. Well, who could tell? And so, you know, we got this bad balding problem, and we have all these people, especially women, you know, who are taking chemotherapy for their cancer, which is now promising to get 100% of us involved in cancer in our lifetime. And then your hair falls out from the chemotherapy, and so by taking arsenic, and we'll put arsenic in the water supply so that we can make it universal and everybody can have arsenic in their water supply to grow their hair back out. God, what a wonderful benefit that you're going to receive. And that arsenic in small quantities is not cumulative, and arsenic in small quantities is not harmful, and we'll just put one part per million of arsenic into your drinking water so that you can grow your hair back. And of course, there'll be a bunch of kooks out here on the radical right and left, and they'll say, oh my God, we haven't had adequate studies done, and we need more studies, and they'll bombard the NIH and the CDC and the Food and Drug Administration and their congressmen, one thing, and they have the same argument you had over fluoride. And this will go on for 10, 20, 30 years. And little by little, we'll introduce it into the public schools and tell the public school children that it's all good and it's wonderful. And you know, your mothers and fathers are all a bunch of worrywarts and a bunch of dingbats, and screwballs and old ladies wearing tennis shoes. And in 50 years, you people would take arsenic along with fluoride and chlorine right in your water supply and honest to God believe that it grew hair. That can be done. We have done that time and time and time again. It's propaganda. People believe lies if they hear them over and over and over again. Adolf Hitler made that observation. He wasn't the guy that thunk it up. The guy that thunk it up was a pope, about Pope Innocent the 11th, I believe it was. Sometime around, the 11th, 12th, 13th century. I think about 1156 or something like that. That number just kind of pops into my head. Anyway, he said, you give me a child until he's 7 years old. He wanted him, from birth to seven. You give me a child until he's 7 years old and he will be a Catholic for life. Boy, you talk about prophecy now. That's the truth. In fact, God himself tells us that if you train up a child in the way he shall go, or in the way he should go, when he's old, he will not depart from it. I almost thank God daily for Judy Hartson. You know that? Judy Hartson. She was the girl that was running around always sucking air. She would go, she was just gasping. Every time she would see me, she would gasp. And then she'd go tell Mr. Witt. And then Mr. Witt, then he was the school teacher. So Judy Hartson would see me do something, then she'd say, "I'm going to tell Mr. Witt," and she'd gasp for air every time. It was almost like I took her breath away. And so, anyway, Judy, God bless her anyway. I don't know where she is. She's probably an old lady like I am, an old man. But, thank God for Judy Hartson because she kept me from becoming a juvenile delinquent. Every time she'd see me do something, she'd gasp in horror. Then she'd run off and tell the teacher, and then the teacher would correct me. And that's what kept me from going to reform school, I'm sure. Judy Hartson. All right, now, in chapter 4, 19 pages here, it tells us about General Groves' problem. Now, General Groves was the guy who built the Pentagon. He was the general in charge of building the Pentagon, in case you're wondering. Well, who was the contractor that built the Pentagon? Well, it was General Groves and the Army Corps of Engineers. And then when the war got cranked up, General Groves, who had just built the Pentagon, had a pretty good rapport, with the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the new people that had just occupied the Pentagon. And so now with General Groves in the Pentagon, they needed somebody to head the Manhattan Project. And so Groves was the guy they picked because he did such a good job in building the Pentagon. Now, did you know that? I don't know. You'll have something to bedazzle your wife or your husband with tonight over the dinner table. You can say, "Do you know who was the general in charge of building the Pentagon?" And his name was General Leslie Groves. "Do you know what General Groves went on to do?" "Yes, yes, he was ultimately the head of the Manhattan Project." And by now, your children will be gasping in absolute desperation. They will say, "Mother, what more do you know? What else? What great wisdom can you impart to us at the dinner table beside eating our broccoli?" Well, there it is, ladies. It's General Leslie Groves. Now, this guy Groves, like this Harold Hodge, was an animal. An absolute animal. I mean, if you guys think that Adolf Hitler and Joe Stalin and Genghis Khan were homicidal maniacs, you ain't seen nothing until you see people here who casually order experiments done on human beings that is going to kill them. And we don't, but you got to admit, Hitler knew that when you put these people in the gas chamber, they were going to die. Groves didn't know that when you injected them with plutonium, that they were going to die. He was a surprise to him when they died. And when they injected these people with fluoride and they died, I'm sure that Hodge and Groves were just real surprised. Well, what do you know about that? Why, they died. It reminds me of this project back in the 1930s. Now, listen. If you're getting squeamish about these reports, now keep in mind that these are black people that we're doing these experiments on. I mean, don't think that we're doing this on white Anglo-Saxons now. No. We're doing it on blacks, so that makes it all right. So, what we're doing here, back in the 1930s, we had a bunch of people. We weren't quite sure how syphilis worked, see? So we wanted to find out. Well, okay, we need to find out how syphilis works in humans. And so they'd have these black people, they'd come into the clinic, and the guy's got syphilis. And they'd diagnose him and say, he's got syphilis, see? So instead of treating him, they would treat him with sugar water, and they'd say, okay, well, we're going to cure you, Hank. Hey, Tom, everything's going to be all right. We're giving you these drugs, and they're going to make you feel real good. Now, we're giving the guy sugar water, see, but he don't know that. He thinks he's getting life-saving drugs, and of course, the guy dies. They monitored these people from the 1930s to the 1970s. So if you think that this was going on during this critical period of World War II, you got your head up the wrong end again, kid. Now, we were doing this through the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, and 60s, and finally terminated it in the 70s. How's it going on 40, 50 years? We have been conducting human experiments in this country on ignorant people, black people. Now, don't think now that we're doing this to whites now, so don't want you to get racist on me now. I'm doing it on these blacks over here, which are subhumans that have not evolved to the level of whites yet. And so we are doing this on these blacks over here so that we can determine how syphilis works on human bodies. Now, after we get through experimenting on the blacks, I suggest we do a little bit of experimenting on the whites so that we can make sure how this affects whites also, since the blacks haven't evolved to the same level as us whites. All right, now with that out of the way now, General Groves had a problem. He's got this fluoride out here, and we got to solve this fluoride problem, this deadly toxin. Listen to this. God, you'll love it. On the edge of the marsh water near the monumental K-25 factory at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, stands a solitary blue heron, its head angling for prey. Danger. No fishing. Radiation reads the sign across the pond. Now, across the pond, the gray walls of the plant glitter in the late evening sun. The smokestacks are cold now. The big machines silent and patient as the heron, waiting to be dismantled and hauled away. Close your eyes and the ghosts return. Mausoleum now, this half-mile-long steel colossus was once amongst the biggest industrial buildings in the world. Here, in the spring and summer of 1945, and throughout the Cold War, tens of thousands of men and women worked through the night in a cacophony of heat and smoke, their backs bent to the purpose of the nation. Here in the shade of Tennessee's Black Oak Ridge lay America's biggest wartime secret, where nature was rendered in man's image more powerfully than ever before. Here, on the banks of the Clinch River, exotic ore and minerals from the far-flung corners of the world were transformed with an elemental genius by scientists, farm laborers, and migrants from across the nation. Punching time clocks, sculpting the future, and enriching uranium for the Hiroshima atomic bomb. My God, isn't that poetic? I'm going to put a bracket around that paragraph. It's the introduction to paragraph 4. Now, it was a cold December morning in 1943 in northwest Washington, D.C. Brigadier General Leslie C. Groves had another problem on his desk. The portly, tough-talking engineer was in charge of the United States' biggest and best-kept wartime secret. He was the Army's chief of the Manhattan Project, and he was its staff, or he and its staff, were building an industrial infrastructure to manufacture the world's first atomic bomb. It was a gargantuan task. In complete secrecy, Groves and the Army Corps of Engineers were overseeing the work of tens of thousands of laborers, scientists, and engineers, who in just 3 years would create factories and laboratories rivaling the size of the entire United States automobile industry. The budget of the Manhattan Project, the engineering district as a project was officially known, eventually would run to more than $2 billion and would be concealed almost entirely from the United States Congress. It was the first black ops operation. Now, the general's days were a blur of covert action. There were secret flights to mysterious giant new factories being carved from the virgin sites in Tennessee, New Mexico, and Washington State. Huddled conferences in the Manhattan Project's New York and Washington, D.C. offices, and endless telephone calls, troubleshooting with top military lieutenants. The United States was in a nuclear arms race with Germany, Groves believed, and yet some of the key industrial processes needed to make the U.S. weapon had not even reached pilot plant stage. Much of the nation's atomic program, he knew, was still mired in laboratory development. Groves had a new headache that December morning. There were disturbing reports of workers and scientists being gassed and burned in the bomb project's laboratories and factories. Colonel Stafford L. Warren, chief of the Manhattan Project's medical section, needed help. He wanted General Groves to use his authority to pry loose some secret information from the Army's Chemical Warfare Service. Warren wanted to know what the military's poison gas experts could tell the Manhattan Project about the toxicity of fluoride, because fluoride was killing workers right and left. General Groves immediately agreed to help. Getting more information about fluoride toxicity was vital. Despite the many uncertainties facing the Manhattan Project, the bleak winter of 1943, Groves was sure of one thing. Fluoride was going to be essential in making the United States' first atomic bomb. Manhattan Project scientists were planning to use a gaseous diffusion technology to refine uranium. In that process, uranium is mixed with elemental fluorine, forming a volatile gas called uranium hexafluoride, which is then enriched by diffusing the gas through a fine barrier or membrane. The lighter molecules containing fissionable uranium needed for a nuclear explosion pass through this membrane more quickly and are captured on the other side. But because only a handful of the lighter molecules make it through the membrane each time, many hundreds of tons of fluorine and thousands of stages of progressive enrichment would be needed to produce enough uranium for a single atomic bomb. Well, by January 20th of 1945, when the K-25 gaseous diffusion plant on the banks of the Clinch River was loaded with fluoride for the first time, the plant's fantastic appetite would include a workforce of 12,000, a hunger for electricity that rivaled the city of New York, and a diet of some 33 tons of uranium hexafluoride every month. Now, the hunger for fluorine was one of the most closely guarded military secrets of World War II. A special office of the Manhattan Project in New York City, known as the Madison Square Area, coordinated much of the fluoride work. Elemental fluorine was designated simply the gas or fresh air. Scientists at the University of Chicago were advised in a secret 1942 memo that all fluorides are to be disguised in that they give definite clues to the chemistry involved. Dragooning fluoride into military service was also one of the central technological challenges, and great events of World War II, requiring the full resources of academia and of industry. Fluoride, boys and girls, was as important as uranium. Because without the fluoride, you couldn't enrich the uranium. Now, this fluoride is killing people right and left. And they can't figure out what in the hell's causing it. They thought it was the uranium. And they were protecting the workers from the uranium. But they didn't know about the fluoride. So now somebody wises up and says, oh my God, I wonder if it's the fluoride, or the fluoride, fluorine they're calling it, fluoride, that's causing these people to die. Now remember, the fluorine, now, is a closely guarded military secret. And this fluoride in the military service, you know, is something more than just a laboratory curiosity. Fluorine was easily the Earth's most reactive element. Scientists knew, often combining violently with other chemicals, even at room temperature, vaporizing steel in a flash of white heat, for example, and presenting bomb program engineers with extraordinary challenges and nightmarish hazards. So dangerous was the pure element that industry had avoided fluorine before the war, regarding it as a laboratory curiosity. Fluoride was a laboratory curiosity prior to World War II. But wartime necessity became the mother of invention. Thousands of researchers in crowded laboratories worked to enlist fluoride in the fight against fascism. Scientists from Columbia, Princeton, Johns Hopkins, Purdue, Ohio State, Penn State, Duke and University of Virginia, MIT, Cornell, Iowa State, they studied the chemical alongside engineers from some of the biggest industrial companies in wartime America. The companies included DuPont, Chrysler, Alice Chalmers, Westinghouse, Standard Oil, the American Telephone and Telegraph Company, AT&T, Eastman Kodak, the Electrometallurgical Company, Linde Air Products, Hooker Chemical, Union Carbide. Columbia University scientists made an early technological breakthrough. In December of 1940, a tiny 2-cubic-centimeter capsule of a liquid codenamed Joe's Stuff was delivered to the campus in New York City. Researchers handled it with extreme care. Inside was virtually the entire world's existing supply of a radical new chemical compound known as fluorocarbon, in which carbon atoms were bonded not with hydrogen, as in conventional hydrocarbon oil, but entirely with fluorine atoms. The Columbia researchers soon confirmed that the liquid had Herculean strengths. The fluoride atom was bound to the carbon atom so tightly that even the hyper-aggressive elemental fluorine gas was held at bay. The discovery was critical. It was crucial. Inside the Oak Ridge gaseous diffusion plant, hundreds of huge compressors and blowers would be needed to push the uranium hexafluoride gas through the multiple enrichment stages. If regular oils were used to grease these engines, however, the predatory fluorine atom stripped the hydrogen from the hydrocarbon, destroying the lubricant and the machinery. The bomb program scientists could now fight fire with fire. Fluoride, bonded to carbon atoms in fluorocarbons, would protect the machinery from the fluoride in the uranium hexafluoride gas. In other words, fluoride would protect the machinery from fluoride's uniquely corrosive powers. A crash research program at Columbia, led by a brilliant Russian immigrant, Aristide Grossi, soon found a way of mass producing the top secret compounds. By 1945, thousands of pounds of fluorocarbon oils and seals were being delivered to Oak Ridge. DuPont mass-produced the fluorocarbons. Their pre-war expertise in manufacturing Freon was vital to the U.S. nuclear program. Thousands of pounds of similar refrigerants were now needed to cool the K-25 diffusion plant. DuPont's fluoride-based plastic called Teflon also gave the United States a key wartime advantage. Japan's atomic scientists had struggled to manufacture and handle small amounts of the corrosive uranium hexafluoride. But Teflon, which had been first fabricated in a DuPont lab in 1938, allowed U.S. companies to move enormous quantities of fluoride around the country. The basic problem in making the bomb, General Groves wrote, was to arrive at an industrial process that would produce kilograms of a substance that had never been isolated before in greater than submicroscopic problems. Solving that problem required fluorine scientists. Without their inventions, the United States atomic bomb would have been impossible, noted the Manchester University scientist and historian Eric Banks. He said, most historians have focused on the physics of the atomic bomb, chronicling how the atom was split, the vast contribution of chemical engineers to the Manhattan Project, and the radical debut of a powerful chemical element into the global stage has been totally ignored. It is a striking omission, pointed out Banks. American fluorine chemists had a huge impact on the production of the atomic bomb. In fact, without them, there would be no atomic bomb. But exploiting fluoride was a double-edged sword, as the bomb program's scientists soon discovered. On January 20, 1943, the senior Manhattan Project doctor, Captain Heimer Friedel, paid a visit to the sprawling New York campus of Columbia University, where a small-scale gaseous diffusion plant had already been built. Almost 1,000 researchers would eventually work on bomb-related projects at Columbia's War Research Laboratory. But after his visit, Captain Friedel warned of possible health problems. The primary potential sources of difficulty may be present in the handling of uranium compounds, as noted above, and the coincident use of fluorides, which are an integral part of the entire process. His warning was accurate. A fluoride gas release at Columbia later that year produced nausea, vomiting, and some mental confusion. In 1944, another researcher, Christian Spelton, developed pulmonary fibrosis after repeatedly fleeing clouds of uranium hexafluoride gas they discovered coming right out of the chute in the laboratory that the stuff was dangerous. But they never let on. They never passed it on to the workers who were working in the factories with the chlorine, or excuse me, with the fluoride. And over time, the fluoride in concentrations that would kill were delivered to thousands of people who died during the war, during the wartime development of the atomic bomb. Nobody ever said a word that these workers had been killed by fluoride. Had they said that, it would have caused such an outcry that the bomb would have been in jeopardy. So they kept it secret. But that's not the only secret. And we'll take up more secrets of fluoride and the atomic bomb next time on the Law Hour and Editorial Review. But let me remind you that you have been listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the law school at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.